association resisting against urban regeneration projects undertaken by the AKP governments in the 2000s. So this is the earliest I found, 1999 earthquake, one of the collectives were going. But not all of them. This is perhaps some of the particular stories as well, but you know, I thought it was important. So in the 2000s, in October 2009 and July 2010, many of them told us that they were two timely opportunities for various collectives to unite. October 2009 was an annual meeting of boards of governors of the World Bank Group and the IMF, and July 2010 was the European Social Forum. So in those days, a group of activists formed a collective called Resistambul. So, and they organized activities against World Bank and the IMF. And during the European Social Forum, these collectives established another new umbrella organization called Urban Movements. So they started forming this network of movements in the late 2000s. I'm trying to. How am I doing?
I haven't even bothered to look. I think you're doing fine. Yes, you're doing fine.
Okay. So it seems that these collectives fighting for their particular interest or economic corporate interest, as Gramsci calls it, came to grips that they must link their struggle to have an impact on the hegemonic strategy. During summer 2012, many of them sort of separately told us that they started getting together, organizing meetings, and their idea was to have a more inclusive pride parade in July, and animal rights protest in September 2012. So the meetings, during the meetings, they also discussed to attend the International Workers' Day, May 1st of 2013, under a combined banner. So for that purpose, they organized a series of meetings, ecology collectives, animal rights collectives, LGBTQ groups, immigrant rights groups the participants. I want to give some quotations. They say, for instance, different activists from similar, they had similar sounding comments when they were talking about the motivation to organize these meetings. They said, we lacked organizational capacity. I don't have the quotations, exact quotations, but our organization lacked organizational capacity, one of them said. Another one said, there was a glass wall that each collective was failing to trespass. And another one said, each individual group was feeling that they had exhausted their internal discussions. Another one said, we felt clogged. So these were, to me, similar motivations to get together. So finally, an articulated platform established. It's called Our Commons, Müştereklerimiz. Initially, referring from their website and from what I heard from them, initially they wanted to refer to our commons. You know, I said, what is this common? What do you refer to that? And they said, initially we wanted a political position, anti-capitalist political position as our commons. But later, sporadically, it turned to refer to urban and ecological commons. So I had a hint there that our commons failed to unite a political position, but rather simply hold a variety of groups, providing them a shared platform for struggle. So the parade went really well. The Pride parade went really well. It was one of the biggest, and perhaps I can't remember exactly, but maybe the last event, because it was really a big parade. And animals' rights protest was really a big protest. And the following year, May 1st, was one of the biggest events in Taksim, and it is the last in Taksim also. So it was, in a way, you know, it was, they said, we have seen the footsteps of Gezi coming, those people. For us, for others, it was, you know, it came out, you know, perhaps from nowhere, but that is, you know, the, I heard from many people active in that struggle, in that process. And one more historical moment they mentioned, there was this historical movie theater. Its name in Turkish literally called Labor, Emek. And the AKP wanted to make room for an entertainment and shopping venue. And so this generated a widespread protest in, this is April 2013, a month before the May 1st. So the peaceful demonstrations resisted, or they were peaceful, but police used water cannons and pepper gas. And again, I want to come back to May 1st. It was this May 1st of 2013 was the first time the masses chanted, "Everywhere is Taksim, everywhere is resistance." So it was not Gezi, but it was May 1st of the same year. So this process, I think, reveals the possibilities, both possibilities and challenges. Okay, so what happened? Well, why it inspired us, why it gave us hope? Well, the resistance in the park, so as I said, there are like 3,600,000 people in 80 cities, but I'm talking about where it stemmed from, what, Gezi Park. So the Gezi Park radically opened the space for multidimensional horizon of meanings. With promise of liberation to many. So the park was transformed within days, let me say, because, you know, from the second part of the month, police attacked the groups there. So LGBT groups were there, feminist collectives were there, environmentalists were there, right to shelter collectives were there, right to water organizations, fraternity of rivers were there, independent artists, vegetarians, vegans, youth organizations, trade unions, workers disposed of their jobs, unemployed, extra-parliamentarian left-wing political parties. So they had their tents, they had their desks, you know, sort of distributing flyers. So it was a very nice picture, rosy picture, you know, in a sense. But in another sense, it was a utopian scenario of what could have happened after the dismemberment of the class movement, dismemberment of the class-based political subject. So this heterogeneity was, it was hopeful, but it was also the weakness of it, because it failed to identify any political agenda. It was against the AKP, it was against Erdogan, but this heterogeneity, so they were unable to really leave that subjective positions and sort of corporate economic interest and unite as a popular subject for something, not against something, but they were unable to become something for. And it was almost in principle they were against this institutional politics. They were against becoming a political party. You perhaps would like to compare this process with the Greek one. So it became methodologically individualistic. It became within the hegemonic political strategy of retreat from class. And we heard it from those people. They were almost arrogant against traditional left. So, yes. So they were continuing with this false antithesis, Nancy Fraser calls, between identity and class, right? So, unfortunately, after 5 years, past Gezi process, I came to realize that this has been, this has gave us some hope, some horizon of uniting, how to unite those scattered interest and scattered agendas, but I felt that it needed an antagonism, okay? It needed the antagonism that would stem from class, that would stem from this relations of production. So I don't know what to say. I just wanted to raise this point, and I don't know how to go back there. This is if you ask me. So you're telling us the problems or the negative aspects of it, and what to do. Well, I don't have the answer, but Gezi gave us such lessons, perhaps for future to think about. Let me see if I have to wrap up. If I have anything very important to say. Okay. Yes. So that's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Ines, do you want to go, Ines? Yeah.
Is this mine?
I don't know. Take it. It's not mine.
No.
But you have a bottle of. Yeah. So we have Ines Schwertner. Is that correctly pronounced? No. You say it. You say it.
Schwertner.
Yeah.
It's okay. It was. Okay.
My German sucks.
It's okay.
And you need to plug something in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's try.
A little chart.
Yeah. Let's see if it works.
See you. It's not beautiful, but it might help.
So how do I open it? What? Should come up there, shouldn't
it? My computer. Come on, computer. Oh yeah, I don't.
Yeah, you do this better than I do. Is it this one?
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it? I don't know what it's called, but it's not that one.
What happened here?
The disc?
Sorry?
The E.
Seems to be. The E?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay, so... okay. So, maybe I should just close it again and then... because I need it in 5 minutes, and when you see it now, it's... I'm almost surprised we'll be gone. So don't look at it. Okay. Right. So I'm going to talk about the mergers between conservatism and the new right in Germany. And why is that interesting, or is that just interesting for the German case? I think it is right now very urgent in Germany, but I do hope that what I tell now also has some kind of theoretical, or you can draw some abstractions from it that also count for other country cases. So I hope that you can also, I don't know. Well, you can still see it, right? Okay. So I'm trying to not just talk about the empirical case of just, and not just, I'm just going to give you German names and tell how they build networks, but I'm trying to give you some kind of theoretical framework around it. So I'm just going to start off with two anecdotes or two findings, recent findings, which I think illustrate very well why this is so urgent at the moment. So one is that yesterday a sociological institute found out that, or a recent poll showed, that 40% of Germans prefer an authoritarian regime, which is actually, pretty horrible to hear, because if you think, like, okay, it's not the majority, but still, like, 40% actually feel like they want to have a leader. It's kind of, seemed extreme to me, and it reminded me, and of course no one in the mainstream media talked about it, but it instantly reminded me of the authoritarian character, you know, by Adorno and Horkheimer, that still, even though, you know, you should think that people have learned something from history, still a large portion of the public still feel like they need to submit themselves to, they need to be submissive to some sort of leader who can then, save everything. And interestingly, the social democratic voters were not that authoritarian than voters from Die Linke, which actually also made me think, ooh, that's kind of, dangerous to hear. So, and as you, if you know the study by Adorno and Horkheimer, they found out that especially working class and unionist people actually then tended to vote for Nazis. So that finding, I think, is again interesting for us today. So that was the one thing. And when you look at party politics, I think, I'm sure you know that last week Angela Merkel said that she would not be, that she would just be chancellor for the next 2 to 3 years. We don't know, if maybe there will be elections earlier, and that she would just resign. And that opened up a whole new field of conservative figures in from the background. And we all knew that this might happen at some point, but now it did happen. And I think that now that she is stepping down and that the Conservative Party in Germany might turn to the right, because all the three figures that will probably become candidates, or the three candidates and one of them obviously might also be elected as chancellor, they will all in their own sense mark a shift to the right. I cannot go into details because that will be probably boring. I wrote an article about it for Jacobin, so you can just look it up. So where I just argue that all three of them in their own way would make a certain shift. And I also argue that this kind of shift towards the right would not, as some argue, help the left, you know, to, I don't know, be stronger and then also make the AfD, the fascist party, smaller. That's what many hope for, but I don't think this is going to happen, and I think it has to do with the merging of conservatives and the new right. So this is my assumption behind this. So especially the what is called the national social wing, and I always use this quotation marks because of course it's not social, but they come up with the social question, and they say what conservative and what the Grand Coalition doesn't do is social politics, but only for Germans, obviously. So they're using this extreme void that has, that occurred in this kind of centrist Grand Coalition government in order to come up with this social question. And this national social wing is growing, particularly in the East. And there are like elections upcoming in the East, and it's actually very likely that the AfD, that the fascist party, is going to win all of these elections in East Germany, which means a lot, because then also the conservatives leave their kind of hegemony, and also the Linke, also the left-wing party, will actually, probably lose also ministers and like all the governments. So we don't know what will happen, but you can tell that there might be a sort of right-wing shift throughout the next year. So this is the kind of situation where this theoretical reflections are in, and I'm going to just show you this chart now that I've been talking about so much, and now it will disappoint you probably. So this is really really pure, as you can see. My chart looks a little bit more chaotic and there's more names to it. But what I think is important to say, again, that conservatism and the new right is not too far away from each other. And I think there's a certain center or a certain nucleus that both ideologies or groups can agree on. And at the very core is this kind of order. And it's not just any kind of order, but people who work on conservatism, also as scientists working on new rights, it has to be a hierarchical order. So there's never just any kind of order. It's always a leader and someone submitting to it. So that has to be, that's like in every fascist regime, in every conservative kind of work, you always find this, there's this order in the world, humans are bad naturally, so you need to give it some kind of order. And this also is linked to some kind of a perception of nature that you have to, well, let's say, go back to some kind of natural order, so you're always naturalizing that kind of order. That goes hand in hand. And of course, when you think about naturalizing an order, then a patriarchal order is also in that kind of center or core concept, what I call here. And this core concept goes for both conservatism and the new right. And the new right is a little bit, maybe I should say something about this, because the new right, as it appeared in the 60s and 70s in France and Germany and other countries, they draw a lot of, performing, they perform a lot of stands like the left would do. So they were social uprisings, and not just the left invented demonstrations and actions, but also the new right. And but what the new right also does is not just doing like some kind of performances, but they also go back to the very core of ideological texts that the fascists use. So for the German context, it's very, even now it's getting really en vogue again to read like Heidegger and Jünger and Strauss and like all these like dramatic figures that talk about, Daseinstiefe and Sein, and if you cannot feel this kind of pure Sein, then you are not living, etc., etc. So the drawing on this very deep and dark thoughts, so to say, coming from First World War and afterwards. So this is the new right, and it's very diverse. Like I talk about it like it's one block, but it's actually not, just for analytical reasons. So you have this core here, and then at the same time you have, how should I call it, like points where I think they contradict. And so it's not just the same. I think conservatism and fascist thinking is still deviates in some aspect. And one is, of course, that conservative figures always claim the stability or want to go back to some kind of stable identity, whereas fascists always have this kind of revolutionary thinking of some kind of break or some kind of final battle in it. So it's much more stronger in the sense that some kind of order needs to be re-established, whereas conservative people would always say, no, we just rather keep it as it is. I'll come back to this point because there's an interesting umbrella term that brings them both together. And then what is really important at the moment is that the new right is fighting a fight for cultural hegemony. So they're kind of getting this from Gramsci, and lots of them call themselves Gramscians actually, and use this term of cultural hegemony in order, and they also call it metapolitics sometimes, so something that is pre-political and touch people, with their hearts and in their normal lives, and not just in a political way. So they don't only talk about the social question, but in a sense trying to fight this cultural fight. This is also what conservative figures do when they talk about, I'm like against homosexuals, and it's all like a cultural fight of what is right and what is wrong morally, and what should you watch and what not. And and so on. So this is like on the surface, it's like a cultural war, and fascists, like the very right wing, they turn this cultural war, they transform it into a war of people. You know, in German, they would always use Volk, which is obviously from Nazi Germany termed very strongly. It's very strongly grounded in race and ethnicity. So nobody is talking about that yet. So I'm not in this, you know, far corner. But I think that there's like, you know, it's not just two ends. I think it's just in between sometimes. And sometimes when you listen to, I don't know, AfD delegates in the Bundestag, you can always hear that they're also talking about Volk, but not saying the actual word, but they're saying, like, we need to rescue the Germans and the German culture. But what they then also, you know, between the lines say is everything must be clean and so on and so forth. So this is, like, really a strong rhetoric that goes a little bit more to that side. And connected to the cultural war is a strong tendency to attack everything that happened in 68. So everything left liberal, everything like feminism, is everything green, like ecological movement, everything around that, everything evolved out of 68 is the enemy for both conservatives and the right. And I think that the new right or particular fractions would go as far as to say that liberalism is their enemy. It's not even left-wing people, it's not even Marxism, but it's actually the liberal world, the modern world in itself. We need to restore some kind of, I mean, it sounds mythical, but that's because it is. Like, I'm not making fun of it, it's just, you feel like it's so strange that you could actually believe that, but if you read the text, then it's crazy. And then the last contradiction, which I think is between elite and the masses, because you never really know how the elite and the masses how they depend on each other. And I think it's very clear that this hierarchical orders kind of thinking depends on a certain elite thinking as well. You need to have some kind of leadership for the masses. So in conservative thinking, this is very clear. And as I said that... people who believe in that kind of framework, they submit themselves, like, they just do it because I think it's right. It's like a greater cause. It's like this order that needs to be kept alive, and then you just do it. Whereas fascists or this kind of, more right-wing groups would then call for the masses to, you know, do some kind of revolution. So this is why I chose this sort of outer line in order to say this is as far as only some would go currently. So my last point to wrap it up is that as of now, as I said, there are still contradictions, and I don't think that they will just cohere in the next weeks or something. But there are some figures and networks who work on something that is called conservative revolution, which is the umbrella term that I talked about before. So that means that they use this kind of paradox to say we're trying to keep some kind of conservative ideals while at the same time make some kind of revolution, and thus binding, you know, the two extreme ends together, which it's just a discursive act, first of all, but there's also people behind it that actually then do it and could form some kind of government around the idea that you at the same time destroy an order and keep the order, which is weird, but this is how it works. So the more coherent this kind of system becomes, and this is when we go back to the Gramscian thinking sort of behind it, so I'm lucky that you already introduced it, so I don't have to say a lot about it, because I think, it makes sense to think about it that way. The more the corporate economic interests and also the ideological, you know, framework cohere, and groups start to have coherent ideas and narratives, the stronger they are, and the more dangerous they are in terms of hegemony and hegemonic projects. And So one last idea that I had, and thought, okay, what would the left then have to do, because that looks pretty frightening and it's horrible because apparently half of the people are longing for that kind of stuff, is, I think, to attack this kind of core concept and to be clear about that you're in opposition to that core thinking, which is then egalitarian universalism or something like universal thoughts and egalitarian thinking, to put against this kind of hierarchical thinking. So this, I mean, this is really abstract, but I think to make the point clear is that you don't have any outsiders, or that you're not this kind of, that you are very clear about your idea of elite and mass masses, and that you're also very clear as a left-wing person about what should you keep and what should you do for some kind of stability. So you know, to take up some kind of conservative thinking in a way to say, okay, what apparently people are longing for stability, and what do we as left-wing people then need in order to also kind of offer something that people then, you know, actually, that people then would also find, I don't know, legitimate or something. So, yeah, I think that's it.
I have to apologize. I should have introduced you as an editor of Das Argument. I do it retroactively. Okay, Eleni, do you want to go? So we have Eleni Mavrouli and Alexandros Minotakis.
Great.
Journalist from Greece.
I am a journalist, yes.
You're a journalist, fine.
So we will apologize because our presentation will be written, because we wanted to organize a bit many different aspects, especially some financial figures that we couldn't, of course, remember. Well, we would like to present some points and some thoughts about the European Union, and especially about all these phenomenon of the rise of far right in many countries, and in Greece also, where we're coming from. Even though the last 8 years European Union's crisis has its root causes in the economy, it has not only been manifested as such. Since 2014 European elections, EU's diminishing legitimacy in the conscience of European citizens has been expressed in different ways, from which the most important at EU level is the low turnout in European elections, and at national level is the retreat of the influence by the parties supporting the unification progress and the EU in general. The referendum on Brexit is one of the most typical examples on this thread. We have seen such a phenomenon also in Italy recently, in Greece, and everywhere. The pro-EU political forces retreat is accompanied in many cases by the rise of far-right, racist, xenophobic parties, which have made the most of the refugee crisis, especially in Italy and in Greece, and have placed Euroscepticism in the center of their propaganda. These political forces benefited from people's dissatisfaction and anger caused both by the results of the EU political choices and the very way of pursuing such policies that is characterized by an open and brutal contempt for even perfectly legitimate electoral results. The referendum in Greece in July 2015 and the elections in Italy in 2018, as well as the almost open interventions in the parliamentary processes of these two countries, for example, through the imposition of technocratic governments, were the most characteristic examples of this behavior. In Greece, we had the government of Papademos. In Italy, it was the government of Monti. This is not a bad moment. This is our opinion for the EU. This is EU. European Union is an imperialist organization expressing the interest and aspiration of European capital, and at the same time, capital's contradiction at national level. This presentation's aim is to highlight that this is not neoliberalism by structure and scope. The structure of the EU reflects the interests of the ruling class and actively intervenes in their favor. In that sense, neoliberalism is not merely an option of the current political elites, but the main expression of dominant politics that shapes the EU. The institutions of the EU are inextricably tied to it. We will use three examples of European Union key policy choices in the last years of the crisis. We will present them briefly. The establishment of the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, the adoption of the Euro Plus Pact, and the most recent version of economic governance, 6 and 2 pacts, aiming to show that in the midst of this deep crisis of capitalism, the EU is rapidly evolving into an authoritarian mechanism imposing undemocratic measures, even in terms of bourgeois democracy. The case of European Stability Mechanism. If you remember, the need to set up a permanent financial stability mechanism was announced after the European Council in October 2010, and it was established in, after 2 years, in 2012. It was presented as the only way to ensure Eurozone stability, and it was established Eurozone stability, sorry. In establishing a permanent stability mechanism, the European Council and the Member States were confronted with a significant legal obstacle. The fact that bailouts were expressly prohibited by the Union treaties, in particular the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, which has been ratified by democratically mandated governments of the Member States. Nevertheless, the Eurozone heads of state or governments opted to establish the ESM by means of an intergovernmental treaty outside the framework of the Union legal order. In other words, the establishment of mechanisms through an intergovernmental agreement outside the framework of the EU treaties means that its activities are not subject even to those legal and democratic safeguards arising from the EU legal order. In other words, it is not accountable for citizens, even though the strict conditions associated with granting financial assistance have implication for the economic and social rights of these citizens. For example, Chapter 4 of the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights lists rights relating to fair working conditions, social security and social security rights, and access to health care. The citizens have no means of knowing and challenging rules that bind them, while the mechanism itself is not subject to a revision requirement in order to comply with the Charter of Rights. Second example, the Euro Plus Pact. The Euro Plus Pact originated at the moment of the height of the crisis as one of the measures to stabilize the Eurozone again. It was driven by French and German concerns that at least part of the financial economic fallout was due to underlying factors that had hitherto not featured prominently in the crisis response, such as unit labor cost and employment rates. The Euro Plus Pact was conceived also as an intergovernmental solution outside the Union legal order. Euro Plus Pact has a binding nature which substantially extends without changing the EU treaties, EU competence to matters not provided for by the treaties. Why? Because the key idea of the Euro Plus Pact is to incentivize or oblige member states to undertake reforms in areas that fall under their national competence. It refers to the areas of social security, wages, and social cost. So you have heard the terms, for example, you have heard about the retirement age limit, it was raised, the term flexicurity, the diminishing healthcare benefits, etc. Under the Treaty of Lisbon in 2009, all this, the EU has no say in social policy of the Member States. But this obstacle was removed when the Euro Plus Pact adopted argument that the EU does not approach these issues from a social policy point of view, but from a competitiveness perspective. However, whether your approach minimum wage, for example, from a competitiveness perspective, neoliberal approach, a social cohesion perspective, a social democratic approach, or from the point of view of class struggle, Marxist perspective, is a political issue. The fact remains that the EU negated a treaty ratified on a national international level through an intergovernmental agreement again. It also introduced stricter penalties for unbalanced budgets. The third example is the last version of economic governance. Until 2011, the economic policy coordination was mainly based on consensus, without legally enforceable rules, except in the fiscal policy framework defined under the Stability and Growth Pact. The crisis exposed, as it is written also in the EU official sites if you go in, the fundamental problems and unsustainable trends in many European countries, as they said, and that the EU economies are strictly interdependent as EU states. So greater economic policy coordination across the EU was considered, as they say, necessary in order to address problems and boost growth and job creation in the future. To this end, the system of bodies and procedures for economic coordination in place in the EU was revised and reinforced in 2011, in 2012, in 2013, in 2014, and in 2015. It was the ESM, the 6 and 2 pacts, all of these measures. Each year, so what does mean? Some points of all these measures. Each year, the EU countries that share the euro as their currency submit draft budgetary plans to the European Commission by 15 October. European Commission assesses the draft budgetary plans as either compliant, broadly compliant, or at risk of non-compliance with the economic governance rules. Only if the European Commission gives the green light, the budgets are discussed in the national parliamentary level. Euro area member states also that have already been sanctioned under the preventive arm or whose breach of the threshold values is especially serious may also face stricter sanctions. Failure to reduce the deficit adequately can result in fines of 0.2% of GDP. Penalties can include suspension of EU regional funding, even for non-euro area countries. For euro area members states in the excessive deficit procedure, financial penalties kick in earlier and can be gradually stepped up. Also, it has changed the way these penalties are decided. That means that decisions now are most sanctions are not taken by reverse qualified majority voting, which means that fines are deemed to be approved by the Council unless a qualified majority of member states overturns them. This was the opposite before. Why we think euro democracy deficit is in its own structure and functioning and not only on neoliberalist option. The European Parliament is the only body directly elected from the EU citizens, even though this happens through 20 completely different election systems. Before the Lisbon Treaty, it was a very big discussion about democracy deficit in the European Union. And one of the main parts of this discussion was that the European Parliament had no critical role in decisions making. That was also something that the Lisbon Treaty tried to respond. And that made it with changing the proportion of the deputies from the smaller countries. But even now, after the Lisbon Treaty, the European Parliament has gained only a shared power with the EU Council, the Council of the Ministers and of the Prime Ministers of the Member States. Only if the Council and the Parliament agree between them, they can propose amendments to European Commission's legislative proposals. It still doesn't have any independent role, the Parliament. It votes for the EU budget, and after the Lisbon Treaty, it elects also the Commission President and a Council's proposal again. The Commission is still the sole EU institution tabling laws for adoption after the Council has decided on the politics to follow in meetings, whose exact content, even today, after a series of serious crises in the EU member states, is not known to citizens. The European Commission is not an elected body, something that has been severely criticized many times, and the Council discussions are still remaining secret. And a series of rules, as we showed just before, as the ESM, the Euro-Plus Pact and everything, is out, completely out of citizens' control, even if they are of crucial importance for their lives. One last point is the way the European Commission functions and takes decisions the way it proposes laws. And this is the lobbies and expert groups, that it's a very obscure process. In addition to this apparent institutional democracy deficit, there is also something equally, if not more important, the Commission's own legislative process. On its official page, the Commission says it gets technical details right by consulting experts and the public, groups that are financed by the European Commission, the so-called expert groups. After years of pressure and demands from some members of the European Parliament, the European Commission created the expert group's official register in 2005, meaning that for decades, when many crucial decisions were made, the Maastricht Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, the Amsterdam Treaty, etc., the whole process was completely secret. But even after 2005, as the Alliance for Lobbying Transparency and Ethics Regulation in the European Union reports in 2008, the Commission's online register of expert groups failed to provide the names of the individual members and the organizations they represent, making it impossible to assess the balance of in representation. Moreover, the register was neither up to date nor complete, and the European Commission didn't respond to the Alliance demands for information. In this study that I mentioned, it is revealed that in an analysis of a sample of 44 expert groups, which were chosen on the basis of a range of key policy areas, policy areas of particular importance due both to the EU legislative role and the need for the wider public interest, the 64% of the expert groups being studied were business interest. Industry representatives were making up more than 50% of the non-commission and non-governmental members. Although in 2010 the number of expert groups were diminished and the control under the pressure of ALTO-EU was higher through the involvement of the European Ombudsman, things remained problematic. In 2012, report of ALTO-EU again, entitled Who's Driving the Agenda at DG Enterprise and Industry, concerning issues of internal market, consumer protection, environment, international commerce and research, showed that 482 advisors were coming from corporate companies and only 255 from smaller enterprises, academics, NGOs, trade unions. In other words, the 57% of experts were controlled by multinational companies, 5% from medium and small companies, and only 1% from trade unions. So, some typical examples of what means the work of these expert groups. Even though changes in the EU institutional framework were justified these last years on the back of the pressure from the debt crisis, they have already been tabled by groups as Business Europe, is the Coordination of National Employers Association, and VRT is the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which brings together 45 executives of large enterprises from EU member states. Cross-examining the Rompuy-Barroso Pact, a letter by the Business Europe and the Pact of the Euro, adopted by the heads of the member states, the Corporate Europe Observatory managed to highlight significant convergences, even verbal ones, usage of the same words or synonyms in the process that led to the formation of the economic governance policy. In particular, control of national budgets by the Commission is a Business Europe proposal since 2002. Correspondingly, the increase in retirement age based on life expectancy, the inclusion of debt reduction forecasts, and the limitation of central collective bargaining in the national legislative frameworks were proposals from the same group since 2010, and they were incorporated into the Euro+ Pact. Since the mid-80s, RT has been promoting the objective of a single European market and of a single framework of competitiveness. Bastian van Apeldoorn examined the aspiration of RT concerning a single European market and currency as they were expressed in the they were integrated in the Maastricht Treaty as they were expressed in the 80s. When the financial crisis broke out in 2008, the Commission set up a committee of wise men. This is an actual name. It's not something that we say. They called it the Commission of Wise Men, in which the majority of the participants were bankers who drafted the plan of the new financial market surveillance structure in the EU. What we need to stress here is that it's not that some form of conspiracy or an expression of corruption, which exists, for example, because Barroso's transfers to Goldman Sachs and vice versa sometimes. The transformation in the capitalist formation following the crisis of 1973 were expressed in Europe through a growing concentration of capital with activity that superseded the national sphere. These sections of capital were the first to formulate a new direction for the European integration, which has stagnated after its first steps in the 80s. New historical blocks were built within nation states and across them, incorporating right-wing political parties, social democratic parties, and sections of the popular masses and the working class. We also have, I will not talk about a lot because I don't have time, the phenomenon of the revolving door. That means many commissioners and the presidents are becoming, after their duties in the commission, they're becoming executives in multinationals or vice versa. Many executives of the multinationals are becoming commissioners. So, are some thoughts for finishing. During the economic crisis of recent years, a series of solutions have been proposed to address the growing EU delegitimization in the eyes of citizens, which have had no effect until now. Since 2015, with the example of Syriza in the government of Greece, the approach of the so-called neo-Gramscians was also tested. They pointed out the need to put politics again in the EU central scene, not leaving technocrats talking, taking the most important decision, creating a sentiment of there is no alternative. They accused neoliberalism for a series of failures and for the worsening of EU's image, promoting the idea that there is an open-ended struggle whether the EU will serve the interests of the working class or those of the capital. The thought derives from Gramsci's analysis on hegemony, and they argue that this can be achieved within the EU through political hegemony. Nevertheless, nothing changed until now in the central political direction of the EU. This impasse has more to do with the EU's nature, we think, and character. More precisely, according to the EU treaties, even before the financial crisis, the main policy and decision-making were virtually unaffected by the citizens, not accountable to them. This, the examples we show, is exactly that. The 3 out of 4 of the fundamental freedoms on which the EU is founded through the European treaties, movement of capital, goods, service, and people, are exclusively linked to the capitalist mode of production, and the fourth one is also linked, but indirectly, because it treats men at large as not exclusive degree as a workforce. None of the two key EU theoretical approaches, federalist or intergovernmental, even touches on this issue, despite the fact that this is the core of the Union's functioning. From its part, the neo-Gramscian approach, while raising the issue, as I said, it cuts down Gramsci's concept of hegemony from its dialectical relationship with the core of the economy, a concept derived from the central position of Marxist approach of reality on the basis of the dialectical relationship base. The Gramscian, and I finish with these just 2 points, the Gramscian concept of bourgeoisie hegemony is manifested through the dialectic use of consensus, persuasion, by repression and violence. Referring to his era, Gramsci spoke of Caesarianism, describing the downgrading of the importance of bourgeois institutions associated with public opinion, and the strengthening and emergence of the most bureaucratic and cut-off mechanisms to overcome a period of organic crisis of capitalism in the whole social life, a process that threatens to disintegrate the social alliances of the ruling class. It is an undemocratic policy without the concentration of powers on a dictator person and without the formal abolition of basic principles of bourgeois democracy. He used the term Caesarianism. We think that this term describes the period EU is in now. Until left-wing and communist forces and social movements criticize EU's structural democratic deficit, challenging the roots of the problem, which are not just neoliberalism and politics, but the way capitalism works and EU's nature itself, far-right rhetoric will be the one to answer to citizens' anger, fears, and despair, without questioning, of course, the real causes of the problem. EU is in crisis because capitalism is in crisis, and as far as we don't work for a realistic vision from the point of view of European people's interests against capitalism and EU, there is nothing to stop far right. Thank you very much for your attention, because it was also very important.